Hello, Story Seekers. I'm Ben.
I'm Nico, and welcome to the Tiny Bookcase. Right now, you're listening to our favourite part of the week.
Stories, discussion, and a high likelihood of gratuitous obscenities, all to sate the hunger of the bibliomancer Eusterus.
Our regular listeners will know how it works, but for newcomers, Ben and I have both written a story to the same shared prompt.
We're about to share those stories with each other and you for the first time, then we'll workshop them on mic. The prompt for this episode is wife. So, Nico, as the only one of us that's actually married, you're up.
Go on, then. Old ball and chain.
Did it have a bit of that vibe to it? Should we maybe reconsider that?
No, I think it's fine. Especially because I'm leaving this in.
Oh.
Wife. After Bob's funeral, I did a little math. Not for fun, like my usual math, but some of that taking stock type math Mom used to make reference to. In spite of my capabilities mathematically, she never wanted help with this sort of household math. But once I'd put some numbers together, I began to understand why. The bank had done the math too, and there was a letter informing me my sums had been correct within a few days. The cost of her service had been pretty dang high, so I had to really drill down to figure out what I now had. I had $630 worth of furniture and electrical appliances, and just around $1,500 in savings. I managed to sell the furniture on for around a third of what it was truly worth. I'd done some reading on haggling, but soon discovered that I didn't actually understand the rules of that particular game. Everything went for whatever lowball offer I was given. But it was cash, and it was done before I found myself destitute. I underwent some soul-searching then. What should a man, freshly into his 30s and not burdened with the responsibilities of employment, parenthood, or geographical anchors, do to provide for himself a future? My previous efforts in the speed-running and podcasting communities had paid no dividends, so I figured I was due a lucky break. My train of thought led me to none other than Las Vegas, Nevada. This was, of course, via a bus station. $50 gone from the fund, but one must speculate to accumulate. A further $28.37 went on travel snacks and a jumbo Slurpee drink, in case they were not available in Cherry Dream flavor in Nevada. One for the road, as it were. My plan was simple. I'd heard of card counting, and I understood the principle. If so many plebeians, less versed in the worlds of arithmetic, and less gifted in terms of memory capacity, could attempt this maneuver, I saw no reason I couldn't turn this to my advantage. I have always been a naturally gifted performer, so was under no doubt I could sell the surprise when my enormous win came in. As far as I could tell, it was all going to be pretty plain sailing. The Greyhound through the desert was pretty boring. So much of the time I was unable to connect to the world at large, instead relying on my bag of snacks and the few books I'd already downloaded on Audible. Perhaps I should have flown. I do wonder if it mattered at all, trying to scrape pennies when I knew my big win was so close. When I dreamt on that journey, I dreamt of the future I was about to make. Mom had been a quote-unquote provider, but never brought anything truly exceptional to the table. I was going to create an empire on the back of my win and live the life I knew I deserved. In Vegas, I could be whoever I wanted. In Vegas, I had a new life just waiting to be plucked. This was all confirmed on arrival. We got there late. I remember stepping off that bus in the first place that wasn't some filthy truck stop and being near confounded by the brightness of it all. The neon colors zipping back and forth. I watched huge cowboys tip their hats and illuminated girls wink and kick their heels. I felt like I was home. I asked a passerby if the casino was still open. He called me a word that I do not care to repeat. Language like that would have him banned from my Discord server. That poor thing was going mostly unmoderated right now, but that had to be the way. I was an explorer, deep among the desert, about to strike gold. It turned out a great many of the casinos never close. A whole city running on the rules of 7-Eleven. Truly, I'd found the ideal place. I stepped into the first one I found and was greeted with a drink. They gave me what the scantily clad staff member told me was an old-fashioned. I felt like Don Draper, only smarter. As I drank it and surveyed the scene, I noticed a couple of things. One, most of these people didn't have a system. They were losing all over the place. And second, the casino was giving out drinks for free, which meant they thought everyone who came in was a rube. I am no rube, but I had to play their little game, so I drank their whiskey drink, and I did not like it. It must have been cheap. There's no fooling me. I took a second from a passing tray, and the female carrying it stopped to ask if she could get me anything else. I said, "No, thank you, ma'am," and she asked, "Well, what's your name, sugar?" I liked that. Respectful and soft, like a female speech should be. I told her and remembered to play it cool. I'm not burdened with the shackles of purity, and have in fact had intimacy with three women, or, more accurately, one woman twice, and the second once. One was a fine young filly named Jennifer at my chess camp. I had already been unvirgined by then, and she wanted to be shown the ropes. It must have been good, because she came back for seconds. The sweet lady who took my virginity was my mom's friend, Jeannie, on her 60th birthday. Something of a treat for her, I dare say. Don't worry, I was 27 then. It was all legal. After my dalliances with Susie, I'd vowed to wait for wifing material, as I didn't want to waste all of my sex energy. But this serving female, Tawny, seemed like she might be just that. She held that tray like a pro. We spoke a little, and I asked what time she got off. She told me 5 a.m., and I said I'd wait for her if she wanted. She seemed a little surprised, but I doubled down, to use the gambler's parlance. Now, I know it was a lie, but it was only a little bit of a lie because I was telling the truth early. It was late. I'm not going to gamble right now, but when I did, it would be true. So I told her quietly that I was a professional gambler, and I had a system, and I had won big. When she asked how big, I made a joke, you know, biggest you've ever seen. She loved it. She gave me another old-fashioned. And I waited till 5 a.m., and she came back, which I knew she would. And she asked where I was staying, and I told her nowhere yet, I'm fresh in town. And then I remembered what I told her, and I said I was waiting for my big payout tomorrow because the casino didn't have enough money. She seemed impressed, and she offered me a place to hang for a while, you know, until the payout. I said, sure, why wouldn't I? So we drank some more, and I did something crazy. I told her about my $38 million win, because that number seemed about right, and I said, you know, we should get married. Perfect start to my life. New beautiful wife, more money than God. And she took me to a chapel. And Elvis married us, and he looked like the real one. But I know that he's in space. And it was fast and easy, which was good, because I am so wasted. And I gave her my card to pay for it, because I'm a gentleman, and I told her the details. Because she's my wife now, after all. And I'm so impressed by her. Even now, as she digs by the roadside, she looks magnificent. Her shoulders are so broad and strong, which is not very feminine, but we make sacrifices, because I take my marriage very seriously. I also get up and help. She's digging very urgently, but I'm having some trouble. Sweetie, do you want help? I try to call, but the words are coming out as bubbles. I can hear her muttering, 38 million. You're out of this life now, Tarny. 38 motherfucking million. Get that guy in the hole and start your new life. And as I have begun to drift to sleep, I feel so elated. I'm about to be rich, and my new wife just wants me in her hole. Truly, everything is going my way.
That fucking voice. Oh man, I was completely torn between the horror of this unpleasant character that you've written here and just repeatedly laughing. That was hilarious. I really enjoyed that. It sounded almost like a Coen Brothers character. Like it was it was so like rounded and such a clear angle on that kind of person. So go on, where did that come from then?
When I got the prompt, it was I like the idea of some idiot going to Vegas and, you know, convincing someone he's won big and then being like, oh, well, I'll just have that then. I'll just kill him and take it. But
yeah,
I wanted him to be someone so utterly repugnant. And unfortunately, I suppose for a certain section of the internet, when I think of utterly repugnant people, this is the sort of person that appears in my mind. I couldn't think of anyone more deserving than the sort of person who says, yeah, a female, when they mean a woman.
Oh god, yeah. That bit about respectful and soft like a woman should be or something, I just coiled.
there's a few creators out there who I deep in my heart hope are doing it as a bit, because if they're doing it as a bit, they are geniuses.
As in like YouTube creators, you mean?
Or... yeah, so right. You know, people on TikTok or YouTube or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if they're not, they're actually just these weird little slices of humanity that is so disconnected from what's actually happening in the world as to be unbelievable. As a guy, and I don't know his name, but he keeps turning up in recommended videos because I'm weird and I watch what I see of his. But he like mimes sort of walking along the street, and then he'll use text to put up the dialogue of what's happening, and he keeps referring to himself as the Prince of Dragons, and it's
good lord,
it's so funny. But I can only laugh by telling myself it's a bit. He's totally doing a bit.
This is a character. Yeah,
it has to be, because if it's real, I cannot watch it anymore. If it's real, my last little crumb of hope for humanity has been whisked up by a mouse of sadness. That's where I'm at.
Ooh, I like that. The excited slurping of spit as he got more kind of G'd up for his for his plan was really well done. Like, obviously, you have so many good character voices, but like that one really went with the story really well. It like the pace paired with it really nicely.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really big part of what worked about that story. Him talking about the whole bit with him, anything that he was saying about sex was just deeply unpleasant, wasn't it? There's just the bit that really got me was him saying that it would be a waste of all his sexual energy or something.
Yeah.
Oh god.
I when I wrote down the phrase, I'd already been unvirgined, I thought perhaps I'd gone too far.
No.
I was like, no, I'm really glad I'm putting this guy in a hole at the end of the story.
She held that tray like a pro.
Like, what does it even mean?
What does that mean?
It just means nothing.
What does that bear relation to?
But it's the sort of thing that these kind of guys say, isn't it?
Yeah, no. That's the thing. It was a flusteringly well done portrayal of this kind of man.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I do have one note, actually. I think there's it's told in a really nice way. It's quite every sentence is doing a lot of work. You know how, especially in the early days of the podcast, you were maybe trying to, like, there were like lots of run-on sentences and they were trying to do too much. Now that felt really good. Like there was loads of really tight sentences that were doing lots of world building, character building. throughout, from start to finish, that was just perfect, like really, really, really good.
Yeah.
The only note that I have is that I would take your modifiers out. So you had things like near confounded, pretty boring.
Yeah.
I think just get rid of that.
Okay.
I sort of get that it might be his speech pattern, but I think he is so certain about the world in a hilariously bad way, because he's incorrect about his assumptions about the world and the other people in it.
Yeah.
That it's I think it's funnier and better if he isn't hedging his descriptions of things.
I think it's like you gave two good examples where I think it was pretty just go to boring.
Just go to boring, yeah.
But he would never be able to admit that he was confounded by something. I think near confounded. So yeah, I think with another comb through, just make sure that. But it is fun to say pretty in that voice.
Yeah.
That voice. But yeah, no, yeah. I make you right. I think with a little tightening, especially say after a couple of read throughs I've done to hear the story, and that finding the voice more and more each time, I think this is definitely one where you couldn't read it out too many times in the edit to really find the character, because it is all just that character.
Yeah, apart from the one, the few lines that you get in her voice. I liked that. I think that's an interesting mechanic, because she gets a line when she becomes important to him, and then she gets more lines as it turns out that she's the one that's going to end this story.
Yeah.
And I always like that. I like the sort of shift in narration, and that was done expertly with your you've got like a how many American accents do you have now? I have no idea. Like, to me, they sound really legit. I don't know whether our audience might think differently or not.
There's someone from the States like, please stop.
Please stop doing American. Yeah. I really like it. I think there's that joke, isn't there? In whenever at the award seasons, in the Emmys and the Oscars, sometimes the first time that people realise that these actors that are winning everything are British or Irish is when they get up
a lot
to...
with when House got really popular.
Ah, with Hugh Laurie.
A bit of Fry and Laurie wasn't really a thing in the States.
No, God,
and
no.
Blackadder wasn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of them were seeing Hugh for the first time, and they just assumed he was American.
And that's understandable.
And why wouldn't you? Because he was great in that show.
Not to like revisit the kind of Fallen Empire conversation we've had multiple times on this podcast, but I think that is an odd export from this little island that we live on, is that these sort of like thesps, reasonably classically trained actors.
You see that, mate? Like, per capita, we have to have the highest concentration of performing arts schools in the world.
Really? Is that right? Okay.
I reckon so.
Maybe just the pure saturation of it, potentially, but it is an export to America, isn't it? It's not really to anywhere else. We're not
flooding Bollywood or
because they've got the money, they've got the industry around it, so it sort of makes sense. I know there's is it Charlie Hunnam? He's been in a few things like Sons of Anarchy, and he was in a Guy Ritchie movie recently called The Gentleman,
Pacific Rim,
etc. But he actually lost his English accent whilst he was doing Sons of Anarchy.
He was a proper Manc, wasn't he, before he started?
He had to relearn it for a British role that he had to do after that point.
Which I enjoyed The Gentleman, but his accent was a bit wonky in it.
It has been wonky.
That was why.
Yeah, I think that is why. That's entirely anecdotal, by the way. I have no idea if that's apocryphal. But I'm fairly sure, just from the performances that I've seen, that must be the case.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough about that. That was a really, really good story. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was tight. It was told to time. Top notch.
Thank you. Well, I look forward to being repaid now by the unmarried. We'll see how different that perspective is, because mine, as you can tell, made married life sound pretty good.
pretty good. Wife. Huddled amongst the wagons, Lorna heard the bar-rag shriek of the orcs cut through the fog that wreathed the foothills. The other families consoled, coddled, or silenced their children. Lorna looked at each of her four sons. Their grey-tinged faces were set with the stern understanding of violence she had encouraged in them. Small fangs, inherited from their father, bulged their human lips as they grimaced in reply to her look. She doubted they would ever fear the sounds of battle. Lorna feared it. feared it so dreadfully that the mere thought of it wrung her heart dry of hope. It never got any easier to watch their father leave the camp, but time had toughened her to the thought of what could happen. Masaryk could be slain, he could be maimed, he could be captured, or he might return to the camp and the cycle of her life would continue. Washing, cooking, rearing, all while traipsing after the supply wagons, which left ruts on the route to the next siege, the next raid, the next battle. The families waited in near silence, and Lorna tried not to imagine victorious orcs coming to loot the wagons. A baby mewled, and the noise was followed by a squelch of mud. Lorna turned quickly to see Chiara doubled over in pain. She had dropped her daughter where they hid beneath another wagon. One of her other children was already retrieving the child from the mud, but they all looked terrified. Lorna spoke quietly to her boys as she prepared to move. "Do not move from this wagon until I say so." After waiting for their nods of understanding, Lorna darted out into the fog which swirled at head height amongst the wagons. She reached Chiara's hiding place after scurrying as stealthily as she could through the mud. The woman was clutching her abdomen, and Lorna could see she had already vomited pale bile. "Is there a child in you again?" she whispered, softly rubbing at the small of Chiara's back. "No, he's gone." The finality in her tone, as she sweated and sobbed, made Lorna feel the chill of isolation. To be womb-bound was no simple thing, even for those living protected lives far from the savage frontier. The bond could be purged, or it could be ended suddenly if one partner no longer drew breath. Chiara and Lorna had left their town together when they were both too young to have sense. They had followed their hearts, and that path was ending for Chiara in that moment. Lorna huddled over her, rubbing at her back with one hand while stroking her sweat-matted hair with the other. Chiara's partner often fought alongside Masaryk, and a part of Lorna was consumed once more by fear for her own bond. The first she heard of the victory was the triple blast of captured horns. Then a great fire erupted in the distance like a new sun rising. It burned hot and high enough to rout the fog from about their wagons. Rising from the hushed Chiara, Lorna saw it was a banner fire. "To your wagons, everyone! Let us see what our warriors have won!" Chiara had been wagon mistress, but Lorna spoke confidently in her stead. Soon the families and wagons were trundling up the path left for them by their warriors. It wound through scraggy clumps of tree, and past jagged escarpments of rock which had burst the fetid turf of the swampy foothills. A last rise in the road revealed the battlefield, and the sight of it made Lorna shudder. The dead were strewn across it, all lying in awkward poses as though they had been flung from a great height. Piles of bodies marked where the fighting had been fiercest, one swathed as their lines had met, another at the foundations of the cave fortress the orcs had used, and a final one by the ramshackle gates which had been burst open with the use of a ram. She saw the corpses of some humans, and many half-breeds, but many more were the broken shapes of orc carcasses. Their massive frames showed a plethora of wounds, each of which would have stopped a man instantly. The banner fire had been lit on a tongue of rock which protruded from a high mouth in the cave fortress. Lorna did not doubt that amongst them would be the banner of Terek, Chiara's womb-bonded lover and father to her children. Without the orcs guarding it, the cave fortress seemed unimportant to Lorna. It did not command a view of a major road or protect a resource. It did not even have that many natural features to recommend it as a fortress. Lorna felt anger rise in her. What was the point of this? The scathing thought left a trail of fire across her mind. The families around her began to establish the camp on the bluff overlooking the battlefield. It was convenient, but it would be unpleasant come the morning. Lorna knew she would wake to the jealous squawking of the carrion crows. She left her boys with instructions to help the others put up the shelters and walk down to the battlefield with Chiara. Some others came also, though whether to mourn their dead or to pick the corpses clean of valuables, she did not know. Walking through that death, she was struck by the reek of it. A smell it was impossible to grow accustomed to, and still be able to feel any kind of joy. Blood, piss, shit. She could smell that it was all laced with fear and rage. They found Terek by the gate, locked in a mortal embrace with a mighty battle orc. Half a dozen broken spears protruded from its back. Terek's head had been wrenched back so hard that it had not only broken his neck, but the flesh covering his throat had split open as well. Lorna winced, and remembered the cheeky smile he had always worn before making them all laugh with his stupid jokes. She looked away before that memory could be ruined, and left Shiara to tend what remained of her bond partner. The Orc Chieftain's Hall was filled with the sound of merriment, and smelt strongly of their potent wine as well as wood smoke. The tongue of rock on which the banner fire had been lit was at one end of the hall. Within that inferno was every personal banner of the slain orcs, each bearing grisly trinkets of past victories. The Legion had adopted the custom, and she knew Masaryk was overly proud of his own standard. Lorna saw he was stood near the blaze, laughing with Harald Trimbark. Harald was one of the few humans in their company, and though he was not in command, it would be fair to say that he was the architect of Lorna's current situation. Harald Trimbark was the mastermind behind the Half-Blood Legion, as it was referred to back home. The Orc War had led to a rise in children born from their savage raids. Those people, like Lorna's partner Masaryk, faced a difficult life within the kingdom. Their countenances reminded humans of the enemy they faced, and the people they had failed, a situation which only worsened when it was discovered that their half-blood ran hot for the carnage of battle. Seeing the potential for pogrom violence, Harald had given over his wealth and estates to fund what the half-bloods needed, a purpose. If you wanted to fight and you were fit to do so, any half-blood had a place in the Legion. The Legion's warpath wove in and out of Orc territory, resupplying and always seeking fights that would cripple potential Orc invasions. For the warriors, it was their entire identity. For the families that accompanied them, it could be hell. Masaryk saw her coming and stooped to wrap her in an embrace. She clutched him close for a moment, but her anger soon flared. "We heard the Barrag shriek.
In their confidence, they issued it too late, and the frenzy only delayed their destruction."
He spoke warmly, as though reassuring her. Lorna pulled away from him. "No shit. See any lessons to be learnt there?" She could see from his face that he was starting to realise he had misread the situation.
"Yeah. Strike even faster next time."
Masaryk stood as though he was being berated by a commander. "Next time? There isn't a next time for Terek or Shiara."
"Quiet yourself. I have not forgotten the dead, nor those they leave behind. But in victory, we must celebrate them."
He took her arm, as though to guide her away from the centre of attention, but she shook him off. "Where exactly does quaffing pillaged orc wine fit in the mourning process?"
"If you intend to sour our mood, you do a disservice to Terek. He was the first through the gate. We feast so the dead will hear our cheers and know their sacrifice bore fruit."
"I wonder how I shall feel when these fools are cheering you. Will I weep like Shiara, or will I feel relieved?"
"Calm now, Lorna."
Harald had stepped forwards to intervene, but Lorna warned him off with a shake of her head. "No, I won't be quiet or calm. What nonsense that you should say that to me after making this pointless slaughter. You will come to our tent tonight, Masaryk, and you will stay with us until I say you can leave. Or tomorrow, we will leave for the border without you." Lorna did not wait for his reply as she walked away. End of part one.
Fucking excuse me. Did you just end of part one me?
I just end of part one. Me.
And not just me. Not just me, all of you listening.
All of the listeners.
It's just end of part one to us. The collective. The royal we.
Oh, I'm really...
Give feedback until I get over the how fucking dare-you-ness of it.
How fucking
the
dare-you.
The audacity. The unmitigated gall.
Absolutely. I think there's been something that we've been trying to nail for a long time, which is that when you have an idea for a story, it has to be the right length. Like, some stories are too long. And some stories are potentially too short as well, and they end up needing to be stretched. This one hit the word count before I'd even blinked. Like, just the amount of world building that I was really enjoying doing.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know what? I'm gonna do a two-parter. I'm gonna deliberately not write the second part until we have the prompt for the next episode. So whatever we decide is the prompt will shape the other half of the story.
Exciting.
Yes, so I was trying to build the first half of the story, like trying to put the building blocks in there, trying to lay the foundations of what could be turns in the story for the second part. Yeah. And we'll see how that turns out. But I had a lot of fun with this. I mean, I'm potentially doing too much fantasy recently, just in terms of what's coming out of my head.
I mean, I'm loving it, but that's just me. I'm always going to enjoy it. Especially with a new concept, I've got, like, before we do anything else, the womb binding concept is so cool. Like, so what a horrifying position to be in, to just not only know, but physically know that your partner is dead.
This is something that's
happening nearby. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. You do see this in various bits of fiction, whether they are books or TV or movies, there are women in my family that believe this as well, that they have some kind of deep connection to their family members, and they know when they're in trouble, you know, that there's like something is connecting to them, to the people that they've either given birth to or were born from or are related to. And I have, like, that sounds like bullshit to me, but it's also a really it's a really nice concept. It's quite comforting in a way. Yes, it is unpleasant in this, the way that I've deployed it here, and it can be unpleasant in life when people have that feeling. But there is a connection to it. You know, it doesn't matter how much distance is between people, they are still connected in some way.
Even in this situation, though, there's, you know, we didn't get to see it through this lens this time, but the comfort of, you know, the person you love is in a battle, and it isn't happening to you, so you know they're okay.
Yeah,
that's, and yeah, then a really interesting way for a character to come through it okay, but because it's happened to someone that close to them, to think, why are we all right with this? Like, that kind of breaking point of, you know, tradition and tribalism is always interesting in a fantasy world.
Mm.
Someone actually saying, well, hang on, why do we do it like this?
This the sort of core of this idea came to me over the winter break. And I was just sort of pondering, I guess, just how fucking hard this life must have been. Like, you know, I sort of grew up watching Sharp and things like that on, you know, British TV. And you get these sort of, you get the soldiers, and then you get the soldiers that are married, and then you get the soldiers who are married and their wives are with them, and then those that have their kids there as well. And, you know, Sharp is set during the Napoleonic Wars, but they're just traipsing all over Europe, not knowing if the person who is the source of all of their income, all of their safety, could be wiped out in the most dangerous profession available. It must be incredibly difficult to live that life. And, you know, I write so many stories about warriors and seeing the, you know, what happens in the battle rather than the aftermath of battle or the effects of it. And so I just kind of wanted to see what it was like to write a character who was deeply affected by all of that. You know, it matters what happens on those battlefields to her, but that isn't, you know, that isn't her life, but she is at the mercy of it. Just as much as anybody is on the battlefield.
I did really enjoy, you know, this, like, the worthlessness of the fortress. This kind of, like, you know, someone who isn't involved in the slaughter part of it, looking at it and saying, like, even me, I'm not a soldier, and I can see it's not tactical, it's not even nice. Mm. So what was the point? What was actually the point in that? And yeah, that was a really nice moment in the story. I actually wrote down the worthlessness of the fortress is really cool, because I loved that it wasn't, you know, a great victory was won and they've seized the day, and yeah, you won, but what did you win? It's kind of it's a nice feeling, because it means that the conflict of the story wasn't the literal conflict. It's the repercussions, it's the ripples, the interpersonal ripples.
The pointlessness of war, typically.
Yeah.
That was the theme, I think. Obviously, that's potentially, because it's, I did transpose it into a fantasy world. And it is a problem. Like, you know, everything that the sort of shorthand for orcs in fantasy means that having them on your border is a huge problem.
Yeah.
So there is generally a point to what they're doing, but it also does feel like it's developing, at least to me, it feels like this concept of this legion is actually just a way to get difficult people that they haven't got the social structure to deal with in the heartlands that they should be looking after because they are their people, but instead of that they're just shunting them to the fringes and putting a weapon in their hand. And yeah it's there's definitely a racism happening here to these people.
I made a note specifically about that, which was John Lawrence, but if he was awful. John Lawrence was the guy who wanted to make the first black battalion in the States.
Oh, wow. Okay, I don't know the story.
Okay, you may recognise him from Hamilton. So he was one of the sort of four amigos in Hamilton.
Okay.
I absolutely believed, you know, not black soldiers shouldn't just be sort of just used up because we have them, which is how they were treated, sadly, at the time. But he wanted I think you can have a super effective battalion of, you know, men of African descent, and I will provably do it. I will make it happen. And he never saw that. He wanted a battalion of freed men who were fighting for America because they were American.
Yeah.
And died before he could see it through. And this gave me the real feeling of like an inversion of that. Like, what if someone wasn't doing that because they saw the value of these people and wanted to prove it, but saw the lack of value of these people and knew they could use it? And that is, like, even in, when you're not doing it on purpose, you're writing history stories. I love that. it gave me a really kind of like ick feeling.
Yeah.
This thought of, oh, because, you know, like you're saying, oh, you know, what they're doing is technically good. It's like, yeah, technically, but it's also two birds with one stone, isn't it? For the people dealing with it, because whichever side wins, they got rid of some orcs.
I think it's got legs. I think that's the reason why I've committed to doing a two-parter of it.
Yeah.
The last two-parter that I did was the one that was set around the steamboat going up the river
in the jungle.
Yeah, the jungle with the sort of. Yeah. These immortal rich people on it and their mortal servers. Sometimes a concept needs a bit more room, and this one feels like it. There is another reason for that to build up from the shorter stories that we do typically, and that's because in February we are intending to write a novella together.
We are.
So I am beginning to wind up the trebuchet for bigger stories. This seems as good a time as any to announce it, but we'll be taking a strong swing at a novella together, rather than writing separately as we did during the NaNoWriMos that we've done. And we'll have to see what comes out. It's
put some meat in the grinder and see what sort of burger we get. We don't. We've never done this before, so it's going to be interesting.
We've written some things together before, but not.
Not so officially.
not so officially or on such a scale either.
It's something that I think, not just for us as people who we've spent an awful lot of time building worlds in role plays together and creating stories together, not just in the podcast, but around the table and just for fun on evenings out in the pub or just sitting indoors. I think it's something that everyone should try. Because if you're not being precious about what you've created, I would say 9.9 times out of 10, if someone in our group, including me, says, oh, what if it was this? Someone else will say, that would be cool with this. And another brain, another set of eyes and ears can just transform an idea from a good idea to wait a minute, it's a Ben phrase, this has legs.
This has legs, and yes. I do say that too much.
You do say that a lot. I'm worried that you're a millipede in disguise.
I'm just trying to accrue legs.
But yeah, I'm really excited for it. Genuinely, I think it's going to be tricky. I think there's going to be some stuff that we struggle with, but that's kind of the point, isn't it?
And whatever the hell's going to happen,
how we do.
Yeah, when we like smash our writing styles together as well, that should be quite interesting.
Yeah,
I think we've spoken about this for years and years, like because we both really enjoyed Good Omens, for example, which was of course Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman writing together. And there are bits that you can tell were one person or the other. So I don't think that detracts from it. But yeah, we're going to give it a go. World building is potentially one of my favourite things to do. I really enjoy not just world building, but also like story building, like the concept of story building. That elation that you get when you break a story and you realise that it's going to go the distance.
Yeah,
it's so exciting. And world building is sort of a version of that. It's like you're creating the arena in which these stories are going to take place. And yeah, I've been really enjoying it recently. I think I had a lot of stresses in my life last year, and this year they've lessened somewhat, which means that I have a bit more sort of mental capacity to really go into concepts. And I think it's one of the things that happened in this story. You know, I had the initial concept of the camp follower, how difficult, how hard a woman would have to be the wife of a soldier.
Yeah.
As the, you know, that was the angle I was going to look at a story through. And then also got to really enjoy some world building with some stuff about the orcs and the womb binding is potentially the biggest thing that came from the prompt, because the prompt was wife. So that's where I went with it. But I also really actually quite like this idea of the banner fires after each battle.
Yeah.
I was quite into that concept of these, like every single person has their own standard rather than rallying around one big one, and anybody that dies gets theirs burnt on either side.
Yeah, it is. I think anything like that, you know, trophies and standards are always cool in fantasy worlds. There's a lot of space for not just creativity but horror.
Yeah.
You know, when you see you haven't seen them for a long time, and you see your cousin's helmet stuck on top of someone's flagpole. It's stressful.
Yeah. It's stressful. Yeah. Anyway, there we go. Two stories, or at least mine was half a story. My apologies to anyone that pissed off, including Unico.
Yeah, me?
Yeah.
That'll be the one.
But there will be a second part to it, and it will conclude.
So we'll see you next week for part two. And as we're starting on Novella, if you want to hear about anything we do when it comes to world building, or any tips or tricks, whether or not they work, on creating fantasy worlds, drop us a message on Twitter or by email or on Facebook, and we'll make sure we get it in the episode for you.
Till next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Tiny Bookcase.
Remember to subscribe, otherwise you're going to miss out on the future fun.
Also, tell a friend. If you like this episode, link them to it.
We'd be tremendously grateful. You can follow us on Twitter at BookcaseTiny, Facebook at The Tiny Bookcase, and Instagram at BookcaseTiny for updates. Speaking of supporting the podcast, well, magic can only take one so far. The Tiny Bookcase is supported by the generosity of its patrons. Those kind souls have really kept my belly full the last year. Let's cast a spell for them, shall we? For rich ginger tones on their scalp, let us cast the Orangi Hedondo spell for Scott Byrne. And for general fabulousness, why not the Ooh La La How's Your Mother spell on Matthew McLaren?
How do you come up with that shit, man?